are screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today our main topic is going to be the R word with regard to the U.S. economy. R word, recession. More and more commentators are beginning to raise the R word. In other words, is the U.S. going to slip into recession? Well, we had only a 0.7% growth in the fourth quarter, a real slowdown. The question is it going to continue here into 2016? And we're going to look at that in some detail in the second part of the show today. The R word. Does the R word mean recession, or does it mean relapse? What's a relapse? How is it different from a recession? Well, I'm going to talk about that because I think we are definitely in a relapse, but the recession won't really come into 2017, very quickly after the election. Okay, so let's put that aside temporarily, and we'll come back to that. But first, let's do a little round-robin review of the U.S. and global economy. What's happened this past week that's really important? Well, let's talk about the Iowa caucuses. Okay, Sanders and Clinton pretty much came into a tie here at the caucuses. And some question whether it really was. Briefly, the Sanders campaign raised the question whether Hillary had kind of sneaked through some unconventional means and ways to give herself the caucus vote. And we saw the same thing on the Republican side, you know, some dirty tricks there by Cruz and lying about Carson pulling out so he could get some of Carson's votes here, and he squeezes by Trump. You know, we have this very interesting development going on in American electorate now for the first time in many years, and that is a lot of disaffection, both on the left and the right. And it's kind of pulling the two tails of the American electorate, stretching them out. We're getting fatter tails on the right and the left, fatter meaning more and more people discontented with the two wings of the one party, the Republican Party establishment and the Democratic Party establishment. Interesting development. We'll see how much the system, which is really designed to absorb that kind of critique from the extremes, succeeds in doing so. Bernie Sanders will never get the nomination. I don't care what kind of vote he gets, because the Democrats have superdelegates. A third of all the delegates who will vote for the nomination for the Democratic Party candidate are party bureaucrats at all levels. They reserve that. That's their way of making sure there's no revolution from below in the Democratic Party, and it's contained in the party bigwigs, including the corporate wing of the party, which now dominates it, will be able to maintain control. You know, they say Hillary's problem here is her emails. No, no, emails about Libya. Remember that? All that talk? No, no, that's not her problem. Her problem is her Wall Street contacts. That's her Achilles heel here. And all that speech money, millions of dollars, 250,000 plus every speech to banks and shadow banks and real estate interests and so forth. That's your Achilles heel. And we'll see how that plays out. And what you hear is the talking heads now saying, oh, well, you know, Hillary has this great ground game, as they call it, you know, get up the votes, that she's been down to South Carolina and all these other places that are coming up on Super Tuesday, and she really has the machine, and the minorities are in her back pocket, et cetera, et cetera. But one thing's very clear on the Democratic side is that Sanders has the youth vote. 87% of the vote in Iowa caucuses, youth vote, meaning 18 to 34, voted for him. That's an amazing number, 87%. Well, no wonder so many youth are voting for him. You know, the young workers have been left behind at all levels of skills here since the so-called recovery is concerned. The jobs that have been created when people started going back to work and all these job numbers and so forth are paying significantly less than the jobs that people had. They're upset with that. Yeah, they got work, but, you know, people are thinking in Washington, oh, well, the jobs are back. We're back to 5% unemployment, which is U3 unemployment rate, which is bogus. It's really 10% unemployment, maybe even more. And the people who've gotten jobs back have gotten these low-paid jobs, service jobs. You got all these college graduates working part-time temp jobs, service jobs. Yeah, okay, jobs are up in what? Restaurants, retail, and they're all part-time. There's no full-time jobs there. No benefits, so forth. And here's the statistic that you really got to wonder about. 37% of youth, defined as 18-34, 30% are living at home with their parents. That means they got no money. They may have a job, but they have no money. They can't survive on their own. And these people are pissed off, and I don't blame them. And that's why they're going for extreme candidates, if you really call Sanders extreme, not really. And Trump, yeah, he's blows a lot of smoke, but he's crazy like a fox. He's attempting to tune in to the discontent, and he's moving beyond the typical Tea Party messages. He's expanding that. Yes, he's talking about that, but he's expanding that, and he's appealing to the disaffected, which are largely youth. And don't underestimate the disaffecting views of minorities, especially the Latinos, who have been dealt very treacherously by the Democratic Party and the Republicans. Of course, the Republicans just slap Latinos in the face and say, go away. But the Democrats court them. And what have they delivered for them? Well, nothing. 8 years of Obama and nothing. Dream Act, whatever you want to call it. Biggest deportations in our history under Obama, still going on. And, you know, the Latinos helped put him in the driver's seat twice. Latino-Hispanic vote. I should call it a Hispanic vote. They put it in, put him in place by delivering key states. You know, it's the youth vote and Hispanic vote delivered Colorado, New Mexico, Nevada, and probably even places like Virginia for the Democrats and Obama. And these people are feel, you know, they've been used, they've been had. Obama wouldn't even press executive action when he said he would before the 2012 elections. Then he turns around and doesn't do anything. This guy's all talk. He hasn't delivered anything. And people are going to remember that. So, you know, I would not say Hillary has the Hispanic vote in her back pocket by any means. And certainly doesn't have the youth vote. She lost the youth vote. You know, the Obama coalition very clearly was youth, minorities, black and Hispanic, women, and union labor in key states like in around the Great Lakes. That's what got him overwhelmingly in office in 2008, and it still squeaked him through in 2012. But he hasn't done anything for the youth except cheap jobs, those that have jobs, cheap paying jobs, right? He's abandoned the Hispanics, and union labor is split. Significant parts of union labor are for Sanders. And when the Democratic Party convention polls the superdelegates and nominates Hillary, no matter what do you think those people are going to do? What do you think the youth vote's going to do? What do you think the Hispanic vote's going to do? What do you think part of the union labor vote's going to do? They're going to sit on their butt in the election. That almost happened in 2012. Well, it definitely happened in the midterms in 2014. That's why the Democrats got swamped. Those constituencies did not turn out to vote, so the signs are already there. And I think what we're going to see is an abandonment of the Democrats. Now, the only thing Democrats got going is that the Republicans may have an even crazier candidate, whoever that might be. I can't believe that they're going to let Trump run. They might, though. But they're really throwing their money. The Republican establishment now is really throwing their money behind Rubio. All the big money is moving to Rubio. It's even moving out of Jeb Bush into Rubio, you know, this nice face, youthful face. I've said from the beginning here that the likely ticket in Republican is going to be Rubio and Kasich, Florida and Ohio, big vote, electoral vote states. I said that a year ago, and I still think that's probably some combination. But, you know, watch out for this guy. Rubio. Rubio wants to get rid of Social Security. He wants to turn it into a welfare program. And he, like all of the Republican candidates, are proposing a $10 trillion tax cut for investors and bankers and corporations and the wealthy. $10 trillion. I just wrote a piece, by the way, for Telsur Media, which said and documented the $10 trillion in tax cuts that have been provided so far. And each of these Republican candidates, the leaders, Trump, Rubio, and Cruz, are proposing another $10 trillion. Another $10 trillion in tax cuts. You know, it goes back to Ronald Reagan, of course. He starts the tax cutting for the corporations and the rich. But Bill Clinton opens up the door for modern tax cutting with proposals, you know, like reducing the inheritance tax, reducing corporate tax, dividends and capital gains below the normal tax rate, etc. Bill Clinton, 1997-98, gave $300 billion to investors and corporations in tax cuts, $300 billion. And then comes George Bush. George Bush takes those same provisions that Bill Clinton introduced and blows the door open and provides the same wealthy 1% another $3.8 trillion over his 8 years. $3.8 trillion documented. You know, look at the tax notes and Foundation for Tax Reform, and et cetera. You know, it's all documented, and it's in my article, by the way. You can go to my blog, jackrasmus.com, for that latest article called The $10 Trillion Tax Giveaway, Another $10 Trillion Coming. And I document, with references to sources, you know, Clinton $300 billion, the Bush $3.8 trillion, followed by Obama's $6 trillion under Obama. Yeah, the first 2 years, 2008 to 2010, he extends the Bush tax cuts, which cost another $450 billion. Proposes another $300 billion in tax cuts in his 2009 so-called recovery stimulus package, and then we got the fiscal cliff. Remember that at the end of 2012, And the deal struck with the Republicans was another $4 trillion in continuing Bush tax cuts, permanent, made permanent now, for the next decade, 2012 to 2022. Another $4 trillion. So it all adds up. On top of that, $2.1 trillion in multinational companies shuffling their profits offshore and not paying anything for it, and we got all this tax inversion games going on, and Obama's not doing anything about that either. He's a lame duck. He's not doing anything. He's thinking about his library, and what kind of statesman he's going to become when he leaves office. Not much is going to happen for the rest of the year, except, there are signs he met with Ryan here, House Speaker, and what they're doing, I believe, is laying out initial discussions for continuing big tax cuts for corporations and business and investors. That will come, though, after the election, you see. They're sort of defining the parameters of that, and that will be that will occur after the elections. So we got over $6 trillion in tax cuts for the wealthy, the top 20%, especially the top 1% under Obama, $3.8 trillion under Bush, $300 billion, getting bigger and bigger, isn't it? $10 trillion. Well, all of these guys are now proposing, at least the Republicans, another $10 trillion. The only source who is trying to roll some of this back is Sanders. And boy, they're hammering him. How dare you raise taxes on these rich folks and these corporations and these investors, these speculators, these shadow banks? How dare you? Okay. So, Mr. Rubio, of course, as I said, wants to eliminate all taxes on capital gains and dividends. He wants to eliminate that altogether and eliminate the inheritance tax. Amazing. That means the $5 trillion that corporations gave in stock buybacks, capital gains, right, and dividends between 2010 and 2015, yes, over $5 trillion corporations gave back to their wealthy shareholders, would have been totally tax-free. If you listen to Rubio, that's what he's going to propose, and there's a coordination going on. There's the stuff they're raising during the campaign, these candidates, is the stuff that Ryan and Obama are talking about, behind the scenes that will somehow take a concrete legislative form after the elections. So $5 trillion Rubio wants to give away. $5 trillion. And capital gains alone since 2012 has amounted to over $1 trillion a year. Yes, the wealthy are enjoying capital gains income of over $1 trillion a year, every year. And that's going to be tax-free, according to Mr. Rubio. Hmm? Now, Trump, his proposals, he's proposing $12 trillion. $12 trillion. And $10 trillion of that is, reducing the personal income tax and the corporate income tax, down to 15 and 10% and all the other tax cuts in there. Yeah, go look at the article, jackrasmus.com. You've got all documented in sources. Getting some wide coverage right now through information clearinghouses and so forth. But, it's amazing that people haven't documented this stuff. It's out there. Even their sources, it's obvious they can't hide it. It's an obscenity. It's a political obscenity of proportions that are amazing. So, anyway, to sum up this election thing, Obama's coalition, I think, is already breaking up. You can see it with the Sanders support. And on the right, we've got a reshuffling going on with Trump, who's taking the Tea Party thing to another level. It's not just Tea Party proposals, but Trump is getting such a response because he's mixing Tea Party appeals with real working class appeals. And I think they're keeping it quiet how much the working class, particularly in middle America, you know, the heartland, is really turning towards Trump. Because he's attacking Wall Street, he's attacking himself, you know. He's a big billionaire himself, you know. That's the craziness of American politics, you know. People are totally oblivious to class and its role in these political things, and they believe whatever these politicians tell them, and they're all liars. Okay, so, Sanders, youth vote. Watch it. 37% of young people living with their parents means they're desperate, economically desperate. They can't support themselves. And even though they have jobs, they're poor-paying jobs, and they're angry as hell. And the Latinos and Hispanics are sitting home, resentful. And independents. Now we'll see where they come down. Anyway, that's the big news of this past week, I think. Also, on a more international front, Mario Draghi, the chairman of the ECB, European Central Bank, announced quickly that there will be more QE. In other words, they're going to pump more money into the European economy. More money. More QE. You know, they're desperate. The QE is not working. You see, all this liquidity injection by central banks has petered out. It's not even boosting financial asset prices anymore, stock markets and so forth, because other forces globally, you know, collapsing oil prices, collapsing, slowing down in China, collapsing emerging markets, commodity producers and so forth, is more than offsetting this whole idea of trying to generate economic, real economic growth by boosting your exports, which is what Europe is trying to do, by driving down the value of your currency, by pumping massive amounts of QE and other liquidity into the system. You see, that's what it's all about. Let's get these stock prices up. And to do that, they're just making money so freely available, free money, that bankers and shadow bankers and investors are getting free money, and they're plunking it into the stock markets and bond markets and foreign currency markets and derivative markets to try to keep it up. Right? But the effect is declining is almost gone. Nonetheless, they have nothing else to use. Although there are signs in Europe that even among the capitalists there, they're beginning to realize, well, gee, maybe austerity, fiscal austerity is not the best thing, and we need to try to get some government spending back into the mix here. That's beginning to show signs that they're realizing the QE and the monetary approach is the dead end, and they're desperate. They got to get something going. Europe's in deep doo-doo. Economically, stagnant economies, and now they have all this immigration coming, this disrupting everything, and the possibility that the UK will leave, I've been predicting for over a year that this vote in the UK coming up, they call Brexit, British exit from the EU, will pass. And if Britain leaves the European Union, and even if it doesn't formally leave but gets some sort of a covered concession deal that Cameron, their prime minister, wants, it will be a de facto leaving anyway. You see, Cameron's trying to get his way both ways, see? Leave the EU and yet not leave the EU, and that's what his proposal is really about, but it won't fool financial markets. They'll know that Britain has left, and it will have a devastating effect on the British economy. But it will protect their banks. You know, that's the only thing the British really have going. They have the financial center there in London, and the Conservative Party will protect its bankers no matter what, because there's proposals for more banking regulation in the EU, and that's what they're trying. That's what this thing is all about. So, you know, Britain's going to have a big negative impact once it we have this vote this summer, and that's going to put the immigration that they can't get their heads around how to deal with it. You know, they'll teach the Europeans to follow NATO and the U.S. Adventure and neocon adventurists here, you know, starting fights and disrupting and failed states all throughout the Middle East. You know, that's the U.S. policy now. And now the Europeans are reaping the whirlwind for that with all the immigrants coming north. Okay. You get what you pay for. Anyway, that's Draghi, and the European QE, which is a note here. Of course, that's a big response to the Japanese last week, and we talked about that, driving their rates, their interest rates, into negative territory. You know, and throughout Europe now, over half of the bond rates are in negative territory. In other words, you got to pay to put your money in a bank. The whole idea is, if you've got to pay to put your money in the bank, what are you going to do? You're going to invest it somewhere. So we're trying to force investment, because investment, the banks aren't lending in Europe, because the banks are loaded with non-performing loans. I estimate over $1.5 trillion in non-performing loans. Well, when banks have all these non-performing loans on their balance sheets, they don't want to lend. And if they don't lend, you don't get investment, you see. That's been a chronic problem in Europe since the 2008-09 crash. And by the way, it's not only a problem in Europe. Now it's coming out, as I have written in my book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, published just last month. You can also find information about that on my website and on my blog, jackrasmus.com. You know, that book provided an overview as of end of last year of what's going on in China and Japan and emerging markets like Brazil, in Europe, the Eurozone, how the global economy is slowing rapidly and growing financially unstable, collapsing oil prices, commodity future prices, commodity prices, collapsing stock markets in China and emerging markets, right? Growing currency volatility, as we get dueling QEs and trying to beggar your neighbor with drive down your currency rate with liquidity injections by central banks, all that, right? Central banks are at the end of their rope, you know, and they got to go negative interest in order to try to get investment. The system on the monetary side is broke. So Japan up the ante here, going negative QE, or negative rates rather, to get a jump on the Europeans who were talking about it. And now the Europeans, of course, are jumping, and so we got tit for tat going back and forth, you know, dueling QEs and now dueling negative rates, and that's driving down currencies everywhere, you know, in order to compete with it. Emerging markets are trying to drop their currencies as well, and China, which is has a quasi peg to the dollar, is going to have to break that peg, and it's going to have to devalue even more. That's coming, and that will be a bombshell. And all the predictions are, and the speculators are shorting the yuan, the currency there, because they know it's coming. Right. And that shorting will force it to come even more as the Chinese economy slows down. And by the way, China's economy, $5 trillion in non-performing loans. $5 trillion, at least. Total debt in China has risen from about $8, $9 trillion in 2007, total meaning government debt, corporate debt, household debt, to more than $30 trillion in just 6 years. $30 trillion, 6-7 years. $20 trillion in additional debt, which means more than $20 trillion in additional liquidity injections have been coming into the Chinese economy. And with that much liquidity in that short a time, you're going to get speculation and financial asset bubbles. And we saw that. We still see that in the collapse, the bubble and collapse in its stock market. And as that bubble collapses, Chinese investors are trying to take their money and run and take it out of China. Capital flight, $1 trillion last year in capital flight out of China. And that depresses their currency even more. So you got speculators who are driving the currency down. You got capital flight driving the currency down. And you got the slowing economy and non-performing loans that China's going to have to bail out at some point of its non-financial industries. And that's driving the currency down and driving the stock market down in turn. We have this tit-for-tat going between the valuation and currencies and stock markets and slowdown in China. And the Chinese policymakers just can't get their hands around it. And that's becoming evident, and that's freaking out investors and policymakers and governments elsewhere in the world. That's why they're betting on a slowing, continued slowing in the global economy, and that's why oil prices keep declining. And now the U.S. is clearly not going to raise interest rates, so they're going to have to devalue everybody even more so. You know, the hope was the U.S. would raise rates, and that's a de facto devaluation for other currencies. But the U.S. dollar has risen 20% here in recent years against a basket of currencies, and it's devastating U.S. exports and manufacturing now, which are negative, and we're going to get to that. 4 months in a row, negative manufacturing numbers in the U.S. What's called the manufacturing PMI index clearly shows a decline. Okay, oil. Oil is related to the movement in the dollar and therefore movement in U.S. long-term interest rates. You know, all this talk about the Fed 0.25%, so on and so forth, that's short-term rates. The Fed has no control over long-term rates, and long-term rates have been drifting up, as I said, 20% here in the last year or so. And that's driving up the dollar. And that drives down the price of oil, which is sold in dollars, futures. So as the dollar continues to rise, oil is pressured lower and lower. Now, on top of that, you've got the Saudis are playing this dumb game. You know, you've got this new regime in Saudi Arabia, newcomers, and I don't think they know what the hell they're doing, the consequence of what they're doing. They're shooting themselves in both feet. You know, they took on the oil frackers here in the U.S., and, you know, they're both beating each other up. They're both bloodying each other, the oil folks in the U.S., competing with the Saudis, and the Saudis, you know, won't lose market share, so they're lowering the price more and more, and U.S. frackers are figuring out a way to stay in business. Yes, some of them have left, you know, the oil patch, but others are pumping more oil themselves, more efficient ways. So U.S. is a cheap oil producer now, as cheap as the Saudis. Right, so you got this battle going on between the two. Then you got the slowing global economy, so the demand for oil declines at a time that everyone's pumping up the price of oil. And then you got the Russians. And they're doing the same. They're going to hold on to their market share. They're not going to raise prices and lose market share to the Saudis or the U.S. So, you know, they keep the money, keep the production going. And then you got the secondary producers who are, you know, tied into the whole thing, Nigeria, Venezuela, you know, Colombia, Indonesia, etc. They're all desperate for some sort of relief on this price thing in oil, because economies like Venezuela depend 97% of their earnings, their budget is based on oil. That's why Venezuela is in such a dire economic strait right now. You know, they've reduced their budget by 2/3. And then the U.S., of course, is doing everything it can to destabilize it economically, destabilize its currency even more so. I wrote about that in a piece for Telesur entitled Neoliberalism Raises Its Ugly Head in South America. Now, if you're interested in how the U.S. is destabilizing Venezuela economically, take a look on my blog, jackrasmus.com, for that piece of a couple of weeks ago. So, we have this situation, very clear situation, of slowing global economy, which is driving the price of oil down even more. We got overlaid on that the U.S.-Saudi fight. We have Russia is not going to let either of them undercut its market share. And now we got Iran coming on the market, pumping 500,000 barrels a day or more. And that means global oil prices are going to remain low for quite some time. You know, no one wants to move. No one wants to get together. You know, relationships between Russia. See, the big three producers in global oil, big three producers, who are they? About, 10 billion barrels? They're about equal. Saudi Arabia, right? Russia, and now the U.S. These are the big three in global oil, and they provide about the same level of supply of total global oil. And any agreement has to be between those three. Agreement on stopping the price of oil collapse, right? But the Russians don't trust the Saudis, and of course they don't trust the U.S. Well, crap going on in Ukraine and Eastern Europe. So they don't trust the U.S., and they don't trust the Saudis, and the Saudis don't trust the Russians, and the Saudis and the oil frackers in the U.S. now are feuding with each other. So, you know, it's not likely there's going to be a deal on somehow getting the oil price back up. You know, it fell below $30. Some predictions are it's going to fall to $15. We'll see what happens. So we got this global economy, you know, of oil price collapse. We've got huge currency volatility driven by the Japanese and the Europeans, and slowdown in China going on. We have somewhere between $8 to $10 trillion in non-performing bank loans going on. We have a QE that's run its course, and there's no solution there anymore. So the global economy is a mess, and no wonder the smart money is beginning to bail out of stocks. You know, there's a constant decline long-term going on, and rich people are taking their money and putting it on the sideline, waiting to see what's going to happen. Okay. So that's the most important reviews of what's going on globally this past week. Some other interesting tidbits here. The economy minister, Abraham Vikius, I think it is his name, in the Ukraine, resigns. You know, he was one of the two non-Ukrainians put in charge of the Ukraine economy by the IMF. You know, the other was a private equity Horizon Capital CEO. She's forgotten her name, but anyway, she's an American put in charge of finance. She's finance minister in Ukraine, and this guy, Abraham Vikius, was a European hedge fund guy. He was put in charge as economy minister, but he threw up his hands in frustration and said, this place is just too corrupt, and there's nothing you can do to change it, and I'm out of here. So, you know, Ukraine is a basket case, and as I predicted 2 years ago, would remain a basket case. You know, it's going to take $50 billion to bail the Ukraine out, maybe more, and nothing's happening. At a time when Europe can't afford $50 billion to bail out the Ukraine, no way. And the IMF isn't going to put that much money in, so it's going to, you know, stumble along into a depression, never-ending depression, the Ukraine, economically. All right. And the other interesting last point here is this, I don't want to use a bad word on the radio here, but this guy Shkreli, the CEO of Turing Pharmaceutical, we've been writing about that too, you know, the ripoffs by the big pharma going on that's starting to reverberate into Medicare and other private health insurance cost increases because these guys are just ripping everybody off, these pharmaceutical companies. And this guy, Skrilly, you know, is now in front of Congress this past week. Congress brought him in, and, you know, he essentially told Congress, go to hell. You know, he's there. He says, I'm taking the fifth. I'm not going to say anything about it. So you can ask me any question you want. So he just, you know, sort of contempt the Congress there. And then he even tweets afterwards that they're all imbeciles. I'm sure that made them happy in Congress. But, you know, it's a big problem. Pharmaceutical costs, especially for biologics, life-saving drugs. This guy Skrilly, who comes out of the hedge fund industry where they manipulate prices, you know, this is a trend. These hedge funders, Wall Streets, are getting into pharma because there's no legal limits on prices. They like to manipulate prices to get rich, so they've moved over into the big pharma, these smaller companies, the big pharma. They buy them out, and then they take they buy out these drugs, and they corner the market on the drugs like they would corner the market on silver or commodities of some kind, you know. And once they do that, they jack the prices up. And because there's laws that said that there cannot be controls on pricing pharmaceutical products, you know, since George Bush, one of his legacies, since 2005. You know, ever since then, they jack up the price, you know, 5,000% increase, 1,500% increase on life-saving drug that save women, you know, like this Turing thing, Daraprim. Prevents infections of women during pregnancies and birth and so forth, and other cancer drugs, Valiant pharmaceuticals and so forth. They're all doing it, and they're all getting away with it because pharma, big pharma, is maybe, I think, the second biggest campaign contributing industry to politicians, and I know it's the second biggest, I believe, lobbyist, spending on lobbyists in Washington. So they're well-heeled, you know, and the Congress people, they go through these shows for the public that they're going to do something. They don't do anything, just like they don't do anything about in tax inversions. Pharma companies are notorious for that, too. So they get these huge profits, and, you know, then they engage in tax inversion deals, and they keep it all, capital gains. All right. So it's interesting, you know, I've listened to after this Skrilly insulting Congress, you know, you hear about solutions to this problem. And what you hear the talking heads talking about is that, oh, we need more generic drugs. Let's release the generic drugs in the case of these brand drugs that these pharma companies like Turing have cornered for themselves and jacking up prices by thousands of percent. But let's increase competition by increasing generic drugs in these cases. Well, these guys don't even realize what the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement was all about, and that was preventing generics competing with these guys, with these biological drugs. Yeah, it's prohibited, not only in the U.S., but globally now in all the TPP agreements. You know, at least all of Asia, and I'm sure you'll see the same thing with the TTIP deal with Europe. Ah, the pharma is protected. You can't bring generics in for this kind of price gouging that's going on. I mean, it's really something else, the way the big corporations have these politicians in their pockets now, unlike ever before, and it's blatant. They don't even do it cleverly anymore. And when they're called on it, they come into the Congress and they insult these people. Well, because they know these people in Congress aren't going to do anything about it. The cash, the money is too great. They'll go through the motions and, you know, make it look like they're doing something about it in election year, and then nothing will really change. Okay. That's why we need single payer, you know. Bernie's right. single payer. Deprivatize this whole game that's going on, that people are getting ripped off more and more. Okay, so that's our round robin. Let's talk in what remains about the U.S. economy and the R word that's being raised more and more, the R word. Are we heading for a recession in the U.S.? And my assessment is yes, absolutely. It's not going to come in one linear downward descent here. I think what we're going to see is what I call a relapse here, either in the first or second quarter. What's a relapse? A relapse is a collapse of U.S. GDP to almost zero, no growth, sometimes a little negative growth, sometimes a little bit above, 0.45 GDP growth. Stagnation for one quarter. So one relapse is a one quarter contraction. That's my concept, relapse. And why is it only going to be one quarter? Because it's election year. And the government will pump money into the economy here before the election, as they always do. But, if we have a relapse, it'll be even more pumping in order to extend the growth period, if you want. Not much of a growth period, but prevent it from slipping into a full-blown recession. But they'll let that happen after the election, you see. We've had four relapses already in the U.S. economy. That's why it hasn't grown. It's grown by 1.7, 1.8% on average. They say 2%, but that's only because they doctored up the GDP numbers in 2013 and added $500 billion to GDP. That's not really there in intangibles and intellectual property and estimates of that nature. You back that $500 billion a year out and you get not a 2.1% growth that they're reporting. You get about 1.7, which is about half a normal growth rate, half to two-thirds. Okay. And we've had four relapses already. In 2011 we had a relapse. In 2012 we had a relapse. 2014 and 15 last year, beginning of the year, remember? Collapse to minus something, minus 3/10 or 7/10, I forget what, and then they adjusted the numbers up so we get like a 0.3 growth or 4/10 growth or something like that. It doesn't matter, 3/10 this way or that way, it's all the same. It's just a statistical error. In any event, we're approaching that. We already had a 7/10 decline in GDP. A 7/10 growth, 0.7, a 1% growth rate in the fourth quarter, really slowed down rapidly from the summer. We've got this scenario going on where the economy just can't get going. And in between these relapses, you get business anticipating that there's going to be growth, and they build up the inventories, and they build up some capital spending, an expectation that the consumer is going to take off, and then the consumer does not take off. Consumption, does not really recover significantly. And that's because we don't have the income growth going on for most people. Most of the consumption going on is really debt-based. I mean, what's really holding the consumption side up is the auto sales. Record auto sales we've had, which now are peaking, I predict. You're going to see a slowdown in annual auto sales growth. And that's been, a foundation for consumer spending here in recent years, record auto sales. Why is it record auto sales? Because the auto companies are engaging in subprime lending. Yes, that's why you can get these great deals, a zero down, zero first payment, zero interest rate, et cetera, especially if you lease a car. You can plunk $1,000 down and drive a $40,000 car off the lot, right? It's that easy. But that's because the auto companies have their own finance companies, and the finance companies are, in essence, saying, you know, doesn't matter what your income is, come on in, we'll give you a car, just like they do with the houses, subprime housing, you know, zero liar loans, that kind of thing. So you can get a car loan and drive a car off the lot. And what do the auto companies do with these loans? Well, they package them. They repackage them. Just like the mortgages, housing mortgage were, you know, before 2008. They were just repackaging them and reselling them to investors. And that's what they're doing now. They've been repackaging these loans. You've got subprime loans in auto. And there's over $1 trillion now just in the U.S. in auto loans. You know, fastest growing household debt along with education loans, also $1.2 trillion. And that's just driving the auto market, but how much longer can that occur? I don't know. I don't think it, I think it can't go much further. You know. So it's consumption is debt-based in the U.S. for most people. Now, the people at the top, top 20%, especially higher up you get, there's significant income gains there and significant income-based consumption. Those two things have kept consumption at least not collapsing in the U.S., although now it's very clear that what we see is a slowdown the latter part of last year. Right? December holiday spending flat, a harbinger, things to come, fourth quarter, less than third quarter. Usually it's the other way around, holiday spending. And it's the same old story. Businesses had built up inventories prior to that, expecting a big, takeoff in consumer spending. Hasn't happened again, and now they're going to destock those inventories, and that's going to take, you know, a significant percentage off of GDP. And all the indications are capital spending is declining or slowing, certainly declining in the energy sector here. So, you know, that means production is going to slow and jobs are going to not grow as fast. So on the business side, We've got, that contributes to GDP, capital spending and inventories. We got that slowing down. Manufacturing activity 4 months in a row has contracted. You know, it's at 48 in the index, the PMI index. 4 months in a row has contracted. New orders down 3% in December compared to the year earlier. Factory activity is contracting in the U.S. as exports are contracting as the global economy is slowing. Right? And then capital spending inventories show signs of slowing here going into the new year. And consumer spending, flat. Savings. People are saving more money. Fourth quarter savings up $121 billion. Just about equal to the oil price decline. Savings estimate of $115 billion, so people are pocketing the oil price decline. They're not spending it. They're saving it, or they're using it to pay for higher prices for medical coverage, Obamacare, medical coverage, rents and housing escalating, education costs escalating. So the savings from oil and gasoline is being redirected into healthcare, housing, education, or being saved. Right. Personal spending, therefore, is flat. And what about construction, housing? You know, manufacturing is 12% of the economy. Durables, purchases of durables, manufactured goods, down 0.9% in December. So that's slowing. Manufacturing and factory activity negative. Inventories, capital spending slowing. Consumer spending, as I said, auto sales peaking. Personal expenditures, flat. Construction housing, declines in October and November, and only 0.1% in December. So that's flat. Construction housing is flat. We're not going to see any boost there. Certain states are contracting, especially the oil states. But even now, non-oil states, you know, Mississippi, Wisconsin, activity and GDP state level is contracting. And now we have the latest, the services index. You know, most of the economy, 75-80% is services. And services have been holding everything up, you know, retail services and restaurants and stuff like that. Growing with the service PMI service index at 55, but now that service index all of a sudden fell to 53, the biggest one-month decline since 2009. So that might be a harbinger that the slowdown is now about to extend to the service sector in the U.S. So there's no signs of any real growth in the U.S. after a 0.7% growth rate in fourth quarter. It could very well be that we're going to see something very similar or maybe even worse in the first quarter or the second quarter of this year. So the R word, recession in the U.S., no wonder, you know, some early commentators are raising that flag. Yes, it's coming. The question is the timing. And the only question is, will this be a relapse or a bona fide recession? I don't know. We're going to have to see a couple more months. We're going to have to see what happens with the indicators for February and March. That will tell us if we're going to have a relapse, and then the government will boost the economy again for an election year, or will this be something more fundamental and deeper, i.e., therefore, a recession, right? Get your money out of the stocks. That stock market's going to continue to go down. I predict the stock market, the Dow, which is at, what, 16,000 now, by the end of the year is going to be at 14, 13, somewhere around there. The rich folks are taking their profits, their trillions of dollars of profits, and they're moving to the sidelines with it, and they're going to watch and wait and see what's going to happen with this long-term oil prices and what's going to happen in China, non-performing bank loans. Will China have a hard landing? Absolutely. Europe will continue to stagnate? Yes. There really is no light at the end of the global tunnel, and now the lights are dimming in the U.S. economy as well. At the end of that tunnel. Okay, so next week, I'm sure there'll be a lot of interesting news in the global economy to talk about. And we'll keep watching this U.S. trends and indicators and talking more about the candidates and their economic programs. Read, go to my blog, jackrasmus.com, for this review of the tax situation. You'll find it an eye-opener.